Welcome to Sense and Sensibility, the Inflation Guy podcast. I am Michael Ashton. I am the Inflation Guy, and I'm your host. And today on the podcast, we're going to revisit velocity and talk about myths and reality and how velocity actually works. And we've spoken about this before, but it's timely because we just had the GDP number for the first quarter, and that allows us to calculate money velocity for the first quarter, and it rose a little bit. So we're going to talk about that today after a word from our sponsor. This episode of Sense and Sensibility is sponsored by Simplify ETFs, a fast-growing manager of alternative ETFs solving today's most pressing portfolio challenges. Not only do they have sophisticated diversifying strategies like a managed futures ETF or yield curve plays like TUA, they also have the number one best performing intermediate core bond fund from 2023 in AGGH and an enhanced income ETF ticker HIGH that was in the top 2% of its category. Check out their website at simplify.us and you can find their entire lineup of ETFs at simplify.us/ETFs. And this podcast, of course, is also sponsored by Enduring Investments. Defend your money. And I don't need to say anything more than that. You know that inflation is bad. Do you need help? Then visit us at enduringinvestments.com. So let's talk about velocity. And this comes up periodically because velocity is important if you're a monetarist. What is velocity? What is monetary velocity? Well, the first thing that you have to say is that it's a plug number. So we go back to the MV equals PQ basic monetarist equation. And the way we calculate velocity is not that we don't go out and independently measure velocity in any way. It's simply the residual. We measure M. We measure, which is, you know, the money supply for whichever money supply you care about. And generally, I look at M2. And we look at P, that's the price level, and Q, that's the real GDP. And so MV equals PQ, we can measure three of these things pretty well. And so since that's an identity, we calculate velocity as just sort of the residual. It's the number that makes everything else, that makes the equivalence work. Now, the first mistake that people make is that they think that because we calculate this as a residual, as a plug number, that is just a fudge factor. But it's not. It actually has some economic reality to it. Friedman said that it was the inverse of the demand for real cash balances, and so what does that mean? Well, we're going to talk a little bit about that today. But essentially, what that means is the demand for cash balances. If you want to hold more cash, if there is a tendency for people to sit on cash rather than spending it, that means a dollar moves more slowly, and that means a lower money velocity. If people, on the other hand, try to keep their money moving, then that means a higher velocity. And so mathematically, the reason that matters is that if you look at the left side of the monetarist equation, MV, that's the total number of dollars spent over a given period, over a given year. It's the total number of dollars in the system, that's M. Times the number of times each dollar spent. That's money velocity. And so if you multiply all the dollars out there and the number of times they were each spent, then you have the total amount of spending, right? So that's the left side of the equation. And the right side of the equation is nominal GDP. It's real output, that's Q, multiplied by the price level that all that stuff that represents Q, all that stuff and all those services, the price that they were transacted at, that's the price level P. So you multiply those together and you get kind of the total output. And obviously those two things have to be equal. The amount of money spent on stuff has to equal the amount of stuff that there was, that was output. And so that's why it's an identity. Why does velocity matter? Okay, so mathematically you can sort of see that it sort of matters because if money velocity, if all else is equal and velocity goes up a lot, the left side of the equation goes up a lot, then that means the right side of the equation has to go up a lot as well. And that's the PQ side. And because the actual real economy can only grow so fast, if money velocity spikes, it means that that spike has to happen on the price, most of it has to happen on the price side. The Fed controls interest rates. So the reason this matters from a monetary policy perspective is that the Fed controls interest rates, but you can sort of show that, you know, when we're talking about managing the monetary economy, you can show that changes in the real policy interest rate, the real Fed funds rate, don't have a very useful lead relationship on inflation. There's an article in the show notes, it's one of my blog articles, that where I have a very nice chart showing that, okay, there's no relationship. The real policy rate has no discernible effect, no discernible impact on the change in core inflation over the next 12 months. And so the interest rate part of what the Fed does doesn't actually directly affect inflation in any way. Now, the Fed also controls, or at least in any way they used to control, the quantity of reserves. And they always used to control the quantity of reserves, and that has a more direct impact on the money supply itself. Now, right now, the Fed's balance sheet is so big that the Fed can only try to influence the money supply indirectly and loosely by changing the price of money, that is, interest rates. But it's clunky, and you have to make a lot of estimates as to what the supply and demand for money is, you know, at different prices, because you're essentially setting a cap or a floor on the price of money and hoping that your equilibrium works out. If you had great estimates of the supply and demand curves for money, then that could potentially work. Although moving a price away from equilibrium tends to cause shortages or surpluses, and in money circles, that would be weird. But anyway, the point is that if you wanted to change the quantity of money, you probably should more directly try to change the quantity of money. But the Fed doesn't work that way. Fortunately, the Fed doesn't really care about the quantity of money. They don't care about the money supply. So this is mostly counting angels on the head of a pin in terms of today's modern approach to monetary policy. And by modern, I mean it sucks. But anyway, for now, let's pretend that we were in the good old days when the Fed changed the quantity of reserves available to banks when it wanted to expand or contract the money supply. If they wanted the money supply to go up, they'd make more reserves available. And they would do that by buying bonds in the market or doing system repos, where you take a bond in and you put cash reserves at in the account of the bank that sold you the bonds. And that would mean that the bank had more reserves and they could then go and spend. And essentially what you're doing is you're taking away sort of that riskless asset from the bank, that is the treasury bond, and you're making them go out and do something, you know, a little bit riskier in terms of making a loan. Then if we were still in that world and the Fed didn't have way too big of a balance sheet right now, if they change this, if they buy or sell bonds, it doesn't force the banks to kind of do anything because banks have plenty of reserves, way more than they need. But if we were in that world, then the Fed could move the money supply around at least somewhat, you know, having great, they don't have fine motor control, but at least they can get the basic direction right. Now, and that means that if the Fed can move M, then that means that they can affect PQ by changing M if velocity is either stable or if velocity can be influenced or forecast, right? So if we knew that velocity was going to be stable and the Fed changed M, then that implies that there has to be a change in PQ. So either prices have to change or real output has to change or some combination of the two, which is a totally different set of questions, but changing money supply would directly affect the right-hand side of the equation. Now, we'll see in a bit that velocity isn't stable, but that it is forecastable. If velocity is stable, at least over time, then the price level is just proportional, algebraically, guys, to M over Q. So if you take MV equals PQ and you move Q to the left-hand side, you have MV over Q, and if velocity is stable, then price is proportional to M over Q. But anyway, then we could keep the price level fairly stable by just being methodical about how we treat M. But so the behavior of velocity really matters there, because I just sort of assumed that it is stable. And if it's not stable, then we have to have some idea what it's going to do, or else moving around, monkeying around with M doesn't produce the results that we want. And by the way, this is one of the main reasons I think the Fed doesn't care about the quantity of money, is that they don't know, they don't really understand how velocity works. And so they don't think that controlling the quantity of money does a whole lot of good to them. But if they understood velocity, if they understood how to move it and how it moves, then it would matter more. Anyway, I've previously explained the behavior of velocity in the COVID episode, which is fascinating. And it was especially fascinating because some people said that when this happened, so when COVID hit and the government just flushed a tremendous amount of cash into everybody's accounts, money velocity absolutely plunged. And that led to a lot of people saying, okay, money velocity is dead forever. We're going to be in a deflationary spiral and all kinds of absolutely crazy shit that turned out not to be true. But back in episode 50, I explained why velocity was doing what it was doing and how we could think about what was going to be happening thenceforth to money velocity. And here's what I said. You have a rapid moving variable in the money supply, which spiked all of a sudden, and you have a slower moving variable, which is prices, because it takes time for people to change prices and for that price change to be picked up in the survey measures at the BLS and so on. And so that's sort of like you have an automobile attached to a trailer, but instead of having sort of a fixed rig that is attached to the trailer, you have a spring. And so as the car moves away, the car goes into gear and starts to pull away, it's moving faster than the trailer, and so the spring stretches, and the trailer starts to move and eventually comes along. And as long as the car doesn't continue to accelerate forever, eventually that spring will compress again and the trailer will catch up. Now, about six quarters later from when I recorded that, we have velocity up about 13%. It was about 1.203 in the third quarter of 2022, and it's 1.361 as of the numbers we just got for the first quarter of this year. Prior to COVID, at the end of the first quarter of 2020, we were at 1.39, and it was at 1.44 at the end of 2019. So we're most of the way back. Velocity is almost back to where it was at the end of the first quarter of 2020. And interestingly, because this is the way a spring actually works, if you sort of were to look at, if you look at the chart, if you look at what's happened to velocity's rise, it has been decelerating over the last couple of quarters. So those first few quarters, and back when I was talking about this in episode 50, velocity was rising really, really sharply. It's still rising pretty good, but it's not quite, it is starting to slow down as we're getting to that prior level, that 1.39-ish level, which is interesting because that is kind of how a spring works, right? When you really extend the spring, then there's a lot of force trying to bring the trailer back to the car. But once it gets shorter, there's less of there's less acceleration due to the compression of the spring, and that's kind of the way it's working. So that's kind of fun. This spring analogy seemed to work better than I sort of even thought it would at the time. So are we almost done with this exogenous upward pressure on inflation? Because, you know, 1.39 is only another 2% or so higher from the current level of velocity. And so the question is, are we coming to the end of above equilibrium inflation? That would be a great thing to know. It would be good news. So let's talk about what drives velocity. Again, I've spoken about this at various times quite a bit, but so some of this is review for you folks. But first of all, anyone who tells you that Friedman said velocity is fixed is wrong. He didn't say that. He said velocity is the inverse of the demand for real cash balances, as I said a little bit ago. And unless this is the only demand in the world that's fixed, velocity isn't fixed because the demand for real cash, why would that demand be constant? It doesn't even have to be very stable. Demand for lots of goods and services moves around a whole hell of a lot. So why would we necessarily think that demand for real cash balances would be particularly stable? So how does it help us then to know, I mean, to be thinking about velocity if velocity isn't stable? Well, anyone who tells you that velocity is okay, it's not stable, and moreover, it's random. It just moves around randomly. Anyone who tells you that is also wrong. It's forecastable. I mean, it's not easy to forecast it, but we know what drives money velocity, and I'll talk about that more in a bit. But along with that, anyone who tells you and has told you that velocity is naturally in a downtrend forever because money is less productive or some kind of baloney like that, they're also wrong. Those are the people who told you that velocity would never recover because it had been totally damaged and velocity was going to go one direction forever, and COVID just, like, you know, really socked it to us, and that's why we're going to be in a deflationary spiral. So in the interest of intellectual honesty, and in defense of intellectual honesty, if I make a forecast and it's wrong, and I do make forecasts that are wrong. I mean, anybody who is an analyst or an economist makes forecasts that are wrong. Then I'll explain, at least to me, I mean, I might not necessarily explain it in the podcast, but I will explain at least to me why it's wrong. And if anyone asks me, I will explain why it was wrong, and I'll admit that it was wrong. If I can't explain why it didn't work, then I'm naturally suspicious that my original model was wrong, that I didn't think about it right, and that tends to lead me to do more research. And I've made mistakes before, and they lead me to do more research. And they usually lead me to come to some realization that I didn't know before. I mean, look, this whole COVID thing and watching, you know, the velocity fall off a cliff made me think about the whole trailer analogy, because we'd never seen anything like that. And so nothing like that was in my model. There is a component that helped me understand what was going on. But you know, when we saw all the money flushed into people's accounts, I didn't naturally think, okay, well, money velocity is going to drop to 1.2. I didn't think about that. And so, okay, so but that led me to the bigger insight about the trailer spring analogy, right? Because I had to go think about why is it that I'm wrong. And so being wrong should sometimes, if you're not wrong in a way that makes sense, it should lead you to question your premises and maybe to change your whole model. That's how learning happens. So if you're listening to this, or you're listening or you're reading somebody in some different venue here, who said that the collapse in volatility in 2020 was permanent, they were brutally wrong. They were brutally, brutally wrong. Have they explained to you why they're wrong? Have they issued a mea culpa and say, I didn't understand the following? Look, it helps to forecast something like I've done in this podcast over the last couple of years and be mostly right about it. Now, I hate to toot my own horn. I really do. There's a lot of things I don't know a lot about, but I know a lot about inflation. And I've done a decent job telling you how it was all going to happen. But it gets annoying to call on potential clients sometimes and ask if they need an inflation expert's help and be told that, oh, they have an economist on staff, or they read some money manager's letter about inflation. And I know those people have been dismally wrong. And it's very, very frustrating. I hate I hate it when people say no one could have seen this coming, or everyone thought inflation was transitory, when that wasn't the case at all. Some people did see it coming. Some people told you inflation was not going to be transitory, or it was going to be transitory in a way that made the whole word transitory meaningless. Those people want you to think that everybody was in the same boat, but they weren't. If you were listening to this podcast, you weren't. I'm sorry about all the kvetching. It's unseemly, and I apologize, but it's been a rough couple of weeks business-wise. But again, if you have been listening to somebody who were saying those things in the past, go find out what their explanation was. And if their explanation was that there's something wrong with the data, then that means they really haven't thought very hard about it, right? They're not taking the whole quest for knowledge seriously. So anyway, back to velocity. And again, I'm sorry about the kvetching. But sometimes it's nice to speak into a microphone when there's nobody right here telling me to shut up. So you can email me and tell me to shut up. I'll try to kvetch less. Anyway, back to velocity. If I think that inflation depends on MV and Q, wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be great if I could get nice, accurate forecasts of MV and Q? Guess what? I can't. It's difficult. It's difficult to forecast any of those things. It's difficult to forecast real GDP. We've just seen that, you know, just on the most quarter over quarter number, analysts missed by about 1%, right? So, M, very difficult to forecast, especially when you don't have, when the Fed is not operating, banks are not operating on scarce reserves. Velocity is actually probably the easiest of the three to model. But knowing what changes velocity isn't necessarily the same as being able to forecast velocity in any kind of meaningful way, because a lot of these things are contemporaneous or have short lead times. When I tell you what I think drives money velocity, you'll see what I mean. You'd have to forecast something which is harder to forecast than velocity. And so that means that understanding how velocity moves doesn't necessarily make us any better at forecasting what's going to be going on in the near term. However, if something is modelable, then we can still make useful if-then statements. If this particular thing happens, then here's the result. And here, you know, so if we get, if velocity behaves like a spring, then guess what? It's going to go up a lot over the next couple of years. And therefore, inflation is going to be higher than we would otherwise have expected it to be, all else being equal. Okay, that was a very useful thing to say, even though I could not have told you 6 quarters ago exactly where and when and how soon this was going to get back to the current level. I think I said something to the effect of, if it happens in 2 years, then we're going to have inflation that is 3% higher than equilibrium for 2 years. If it happens over 3 years, then we'll have 2% higher than equilibrium for 3 years. But, you know, that's the sort of thing that you're able to say, and that's not super useful in a lot of ways. So let's talk about how to model velocity. I'm not going to tell you exactly how my model's calibrated and everything, but I'll tell you basically what's in the model. And then I'll tell you what I think that means for where we are and where what's going to happen to velocity going forward, and therefore what's going to happen to inflation going forward. Remember that the job that if we're going to model velocity, what we're really trying to do is model the inverse of the demand for real cash balances, or model the demand for real cash balances and then take the inverse of that. So what affects the demand for cash balances? And that's the question. Anything which makes it more likely that you want to hold a lot of cash in the bank or in physical cash, that lowers velocity if you want to hold a lot of cash. Anything which makes it more likely that you want to hold less cash raises velocity. And that's just sort of definitionally, and that's what Friedman told us. The biggest single effect is the presence of better return opportunities than cash. You can simply look at a chart of velocity against the 10-year yield over the last 30 years, and you get an amazingly good fit. When interest rates went up, velocity went up. When interest rates went down, velocity went down. And it's an amazingly good fit. I find that it helps to include some other assets, you know, equities, you know, some other things that we could look at the valuations of. But on a first pass, the spread between checking account interest rates and longer-term interest rates is a big factor. When 10-year interest rates were at 1.5%, why wouldn't you hold cash? You know, you weren't making anything, but to go out 10 years, you only made slightly more and you took a lot more risk. So, I mean, the incentive to hold cash or the disincentive to hold cash wasn't really there. But if interest rates are much, much higher, then you want to put cash to work, as it were. And you'll buy a longer term bond or something like that and not hold as much cash. So another reason that people hold cash, moving on from that factor, is fear. You know, uncertainty about the future makes us want to hold some, you know, precautionary cash. If you're not sure what's going to happen in the economy or with taxes or with other government economic policies or the Fed or whatever, then all else equal, you're going to hold more cash. Now, I actually use an index from Baker, Bloom, and Davis called the U.S. Economic Policy Uncertainty Index as sort of my input. And this index is interesting. It counts the number of articles in U.S.-based news sources that contain at least one mention of economy or economic, at least one mention of uncertain or uncertainty, and at least one of the following words: legislation, deficit, regulation, Congress, Federal Reserve, or White House. And so it just counts up all of the articles that contain one of each of those three categories of words. It's entirely objective. It's also crazy volatile because it depends who's going to write what when, as you might suspect. So I take a nice long smoothing period as sort of my input for measuring whether there's more volatility in you know, there's more uncertainty about economic policy, and when there is, I would expect people to hold more cash. I wonder if you can use Google N-grams or something fancier like that these days, but that index has worked pretty well for me for a while. And finally, the third factor that I use, and it's a smallish effect, but I have it in my model. It's sort of funny. One reason that people hold more cash is that there's more cash to hold, which sounds weird and redundant. But what I mean is this. Let's suppose you have $1,000. If you're holding, if I look at you, you have $1,000, and I look at you and you're holding $10 in cash in your wallet and $990 in the bank. Are you more or less likely to be spending money than if I look at you and you're holding $300 in cash in your wallet and $700 in the bank? My research says, and common sense says, that if the amount of cash in the composition of M2 is higher, then there's a higher velocity of money because people are positioning themselves to spend cash. Now, as the world gets to be less and less, or more and more cashless, I mean, I noticed that I hardly ever use cash anymore, that factor is probably going to become less and less useful. As it is, it's a pretty small component in my model, but I do have some suspicions that it may become not very useful over time. Anyway, so those are my main three pieces of my model, and let's look at these three pieces and sort of wrap up today's long episode. First of all, the spring between the trailer and the car. So that's sort of a separate effect than what I'm talking about modeling here. Okay, so the little spring effect was because all of a sudden the car accelerated and went moving away rapidly because of really abrupt policy or monetary changes during COVID. And that's something which is not, well, we hope isn't going to be repeated anytime soon. That effect, that spring closing, is getting close to being done, as I said. We're at 1.36, and we should be expecting it to go to 1.39 or 1.40, okay? So we've got another 2 or 3% there. But there's an additional question here, and that's where would we expect velocity to be in the absence of COVID? If the spring thing had never happened, and we just had all these other, you know, we had interest rates where they are now, and we had policy uncertainty where it is and so on, what would we expect velocity to be? So once the spring effect is gone, where would we expect velocity to be headed? So I'm going to ignore the cache as the proportion of M2 part because that moves slowly and it's small, and I don't know that I can say a whole lot useful about that. But let's look at the other two pieces. One, people are more uncertain about the future now than they were pre-COVID. They're much less uncertain than they were during COVID. I mean, COVID was crazy, you know, and you had lots of cash in your account, partly because the government flushed a bunch of it there, but also partly because you didn't mind having a lot of cash because you didn't know what was going to happen next. And so uncertainty is less than it was during COVID, but it's still quite a bit higher using that index. It's at least 20 for the level of uncertainty is at least 25% higher now than it was pre-COVID. We have larger deficits, much larger deficits than we did pre-COVID, and a much bigger spread in the economic policy intentions of two very contentious political parties. I think prior to COVID, and you know, maybe 2017, 18, you know, there were differences in the parties, but they were, you know, there's something about this uniparty idea that you know, both parties want to spend a whole bunch, and in the grand scheme of things, they were pretty similar. That's gotten a lot less true over the last half decade or so. And so when you have two very contentious political parties with very different views and, you know, you're tracking how they're likely to be doing, that adds to uncertainty. And by the way, you also have a much more active Federal Reserve than we'd had for many, many, many years. All those things combine to make people more nervous. And that means that they're going to have a tendency to hold more cash, and that lowers velocity. So that would be a good thing. Unfortunately, there's the much larger effect is in the other direction, and that's the huge change in interest rates since prior to COVID. Just prior to COVID happening, long-term interest rates were around 1.5%. Okay, now they're closing in on 5. The last time interest rates were this high, in fact, like say the 10-year rate, was back in 2007. And at that time, if you looked at where money velocity was, it was around 1.8. And as a reminder, we're not quite at 1.4 yet. So that's way higher than it is now. Now, there's much less policy uncertainty and other markets. You know, for example, equities were not as expensive as they are now. So 1.8 isn't the number we're going to be aiming at here with velocity, but my model still says 1.6 is where velocity, quote, ought to be. And when I talk about the vicious cycle, by the way, I'll occasionally talk about this. Actually, maybe I haven't talked about it in a while. What I mean is that higher inflation causes higher interest rates. Those higher interest rates cause higher money velocity, and higher money velocity means higher inflation, which starts the cycle going around again. And you can describe a lot of the economic history of this country over the last 40 years with interest rates coming down as being the virtuous cycle, the opposite happening, that, you know, lower inflation, you got lower interest rates, which means you got lower velocity and therefore lower inflation and so on and so forth. And now we've kicked it in the opposite direction. And so my model says 1.6 is where we ought to be in velocity. Now, we're not going to get to 1.6 very fast, or else we'd have very high inflation in the very short term. And I'm willing to believe that there could be some missing effect relating to how fast interest rates are moving, maybe, or something like that. So maybe 1.6 is overstating it. But the point is that the baseline here isn't that we just get back to where velocity was just prior to COVID. The baseline is, no, velocity is going to end up, it's going to continue to go higher. It's not permanently broken like people have told you. It responds in a very reasonable way to alternative uses for cash and to precautionary demand for cash balances. And those things tell us that we're likely to see velocity continue on higher to here. And the dynamics of velocity support my view, basically, that And one of the reasons that I have the view that we're going to see inflation sticky in the high threes, low fours on median CPI for a while. And we'll just have to wait and see how long the dynamics of money supply, the dynamics of real output, and lots of other things come into play. But the velocity is not helping. And on that cheery note, that's all for today's podcast. I would really appreciate it if you would refer this blog, this podcast, to others. Read the show notes. There's some good blog posts and links in there. And the episode 50 of the podcast is linked in there. Refer other people. And you can contact me if you have any questions, inflationguy@enduringinvestments.com. If you need any help, you can subscribe for free to the blog that I just mentioned, inflationguy.blog. Visit Enduring Investments if you have an inflation challenge. But most importantly, defend your money. And if inflation is coming for you, remember, you know a guy.